This is Where We Live.
But do you know who uses cubicles? Every single Fortune 500 company. Why? Because they work.
He's trying to turn us into corporate rock, Richard.
No.
We are punk rock.
Actually, you know, I think a better analogy would be jazz, like we riff and improvise around a central theme to create one cohesive piece of music.
That's all from the HBO show Silicon Valley. Now, Silicon Valley, there's a place where we can envision workers unpinned from the dreaded cubicle, roaming free in open space, beanbag chairs and ping pong tables meant to stimulate the mind. But really, are the newfangled design ideas of the modern tech startup anything more than the latest evolutionary blip on the timeline of the American worker? A new book by Nikhil Saval, Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace, explores this evolution from the rise of the white-collar worker to the action office, which later became the soulless cubicle. This book is really more about the people who work in these spaces and how their environments shape their work and the other way around. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, our number is 860-275-7266. You can always comment on our website, WNPR.org, or you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Where We Live if you don't want to have the boss see you calling us during the workday. We want to hear about the office space that you work in, cubicles or open space, an office with a door, or are you home in your pajamas? How has the workspace changed in your working life? We'd like to hear from you. Coming up later, we'll hear from Connecticut artist Joe Figg, who tells us how he's been using his craft to recreate the workspaces of some of today's leading artists. But first, I want to welcome in Nikhil Saval. He's editor of N Plus One. He's also author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. He joins us today from WHYY in Philadelphia. Nikhil, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what drew you to this idea in the first place? Why are you so interested in office design?
I ask myself that question a lot of times while writing this book. I got interested in the office principally because I was working in an office. It was my first job out of college at a large corporate publishing house. And, I was just fascinated. I had my first cubicle and I thought I was really excited by it. I thought I was participating in this great universal experience, having a cubicle. What happened is I started to become fascinated by the way the kind of power relations in the office sort of were reflected by the way the design of the office, the way there were corridor offices around the side that were given to people based on their status or prestige in the company, and then the sort of drones in the center working in these cubicles who often had work that was not very well served by these cubicles. And so over time, as I moved offices and began to compare layouts and ideas, the inklings of a sort of connection between design and work started to come into view. And I realized that lots of people were interested in this. People love talking about offices and where they work and how they work, and no one had really explored it. So that's how I got into it.
And as we get into the history a little bit, it seems as though in one way or another, there's always this complaint from the, as you say, drones in the middle, that their workspace is not optimized. Has it always been that way, that indeed we provide spaces for workers that aren't really the spaces they need to do the work we've asked them to do?
Yeah, in a way, that's kind of the returning, the office is sort of a story of these utopian proposals to make work better, to design better spaces. And in some ways, they often fail because they're usually predicated not on the needs of the people working in them, but it's some kind of conception, megalomaniacal or otherwise, on the part of the designer or planners or business managers or what have you. There's a way in which, from the early 20th century, when scientific management efficiency experts started to design offices along the lines of factory work, to mid-century with the rise of the open office plan or later the office cubicle, and even today, the kind of return of open office plans, you have a lot of these designs that do not suit the needs and desires of workers.
Can you talk about the influence of the book White Collar on the work that you've done here in Cubed?
Absolutely. White Collar, as some people may know, is a classic work of sociology by C. Wright Mills, one of the greatest American thinkers, social critics of the 20th century. And, it came out in 1951 when it became clear that in the United States, at least, and soon in the rest of the world, that the percentage of white-collar workers was going to overtake that of blue-collar workers. And this was a momentous change. And what C. Wright Mills wanted to figure out was what they represented in terms of politics, the changing social mores, things like that in the workplace, what the rise of this so-called new middle class would do. And Mills was quite scathing about this. He thought white-collar workers were sort of passive, dependent figures. They had no sort of political agency. They didn't really unionize. They had no sense of themselves as belonging to any kind of class. And at the same time that their work was rationalized and bureaucratized. And so there was a high level of false consciousness. And that was, you know, in a way I wanted to trace the history since then, since the 50s, and maybe not put things in quite so scathing a light, although I did have a sort of social and political purpose to the book. It was the fact that I worked in an office, so many people I know work in offices, most Americans are white-collar workers, that made it hard to take the sort of tone that Mills took. But in a way, I wanted to make a book that I thought was for office workers and that office workers could read.
We're talking with Nikhil Saval, an editor of N Plus One, also author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. He joins us today from WHYY in Philadelphia as we talk about the modern workspace. And we want to hear your stories, whether you're at work right now or you've got workplace stories about how it's changed over time. We'd love to hear from you at 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. I want to bring in Tony Amenta, who's principal at Amenta Emma Architects. Tony, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate it.
Well, John, thank you. It's great to be here.
I'd like to get your take on how you feel the American workplace has changed since you've been doing this work, Tony.
Yeah. You know, I've been doing it a while, so I've seen a lot of change. But it's really, for us, geographical. And the book refers to that as well. You've got some leaders, sort of the West Coast now, and so you see influences over the years kind of come across in waves. And so in Connecticut, we're in a certain phase of that right now. And, you know, other places have been in that phase maybe 5 years ago or 10 years ago.
So what phase? Describe the phase that we're in.
Okay. We're starting to open up a little bit. Our cubicles are coming down. Some of the more progressive companies are eliminating the partitions and going to a more open office look, which we've seen in New York and on the West Coast for many years. So we're just finding that trend to be something that is starting to be embraced. And I say starting because, you know, it's industry dependent as well. You've got some conservative or more engineering based industries that are not buying into anything but a tall cubicle still.
And that's interesting. So, Nikhil, pick up on this because it sounds to me as one thing, which always happens in America, which is there are trends. Something becomes fashionable. But then there's another trend in business, which is something seems to work for certain businesses. Therefore, we can make more profits. It's better to invest in a different sort of workspace if we feel like we can make money at it. How do you see these trends, Nikhil?
Yeah, I mean, the trends are often, I think, a combination of ideology and efficiency and some, you know, some genuine enlightened or at least earnest thinking. I mean, the open office plan, the kind of opening up of the office is a case in point to the extent that it certainly is a trend to the extent that a lot of people, I mean, the tech industry has put in open office plans for a while. The tech industry is seen as progressive by a lot of other industries, and so they start to adopt them. And, you know, at the same time, it's obviously much cheaper to put people in open office plans. You can put people in more people in less space. That was true of the cubicle as well. This is beyond the level of. You know, there's very little empirical basis, I think, for opening up these offices. They produce noise, visual distraction, oral distraction. People tend not to like them in surveys. They're psychologically very stressful. I think there's a way in which the trend is clearly an attempt to cut down on costs at the same time that it's seen as inducing collaboration and, you know, all those sorts of buzzwords, innovation, spontaneous encounters. So I don't know. I'm pretty skeptical of this trend in particular, and those trends in general. I think that they're often they're often go above the heads of the people who are actually doing the work.
Well, Tony, I'd like to hear from you because you obviously talk to clients all the time and you hear the stories about whether it's from managers or office workers, what I want my space to feel like. And probably managers and office workers have very different ideas about what those two things are. I mean, what are people saying to you about these trends, about opening things up or wanting to have personal space? I mean, give me some anecdotes so that we understand a little bit better what people are saying about their offices today.
You know, it's interesting because I do think that there isn't as much input as there should be. We're still seeing those types of decisions made by facilities managers or real estate people.
And you're doing air quotes there, which I love, and I know what you mean exactly.
Okay, sorry about that. No. Forget that I'm right here with you, John. So what I'm saying is that the decisions for space and how people spend the majority of their waking time is being made by folks not from a productivity standpoint, but from an economic standpoint. How many people can we cram in? You know, how small can the cubicles be, and how do we reduce our operational costs by squeezing people in? Those are what we're hearing, and if they fail, we do get the feedback because, you know, the occupants, right after you move in, you get some strange things happening. I'll tell you one little story. We were doing some cubicles, and the real estate manager wanted them to be a certain height, which is above eye level, so no one could see anyone else, and we convinced them to put some the top layer to be glass, so that at least you know you could look out, even though it gave you a little bit more acoustical privacy. Well, people on the corridor row moved in and taped cardboard over the glass. They didn't want anybody seeing in, and you know, so you start to understand that these things affect people, and they're gonna modify their space if they can to make themselves more comfortable.
Near the end of your book, Nikhil, you write about the shrinking cubicle space. According to a Business Week editorial from 1997, between the mid-80s and the mid-90s, the average size of a cubicle decreased between 25 and 50%. And this sort of shrinking cubicle space is something that people take very seriously. Even from your experience, Nikhil, as you said, you were drawn to write about this. The space that we have, that we are given at work, it helps to define us. How much space I have in relation to the next guy, how much room I have to put my personal ephemera up versus the person next to me. These are all very important parts of office politics, which is really, I think, at the heart of what your book is about, not so much the space itself.
Yeah, I mean, the truth is that, you know, the space is often more a reflection or a fraction of something deeper about office work and or where you work than it is totally determining. I mean, I think I'm sure there are plenty of places that are just all cubicle offices that are actually quite vibrant and exciting places, and more progressive offices that are, or seemingly progressive, that are not so great. I think the thing is, you see, you know, I mean, even just the kind of hatred of the office cubicle didn't come out in the 60s and 70s when Robert Probst, the inventor of what became the office cubicle, debuted Action Office. It was seen as this kind of liberation. And for years, you don't see any mention of it. And then it's really by the late 80s and then the 90s when certain things start to happen to work. Layoffs become more common. Mergers and acquisitions mean that people are being shuttled from, you know, private offices to cubicles, cost, like overhead and all that stuff starts to affect the shape of offices, that things like Dilbert, which debuted in 1989 or, you know, by the end of the 90s, Office Space, you see this sudden rise in cubicle hatred and even the phrase cubicle rage when there's a kind of spate of office shootings. And, you know, there's this term pops up. And I think that's a result of people, you know, that's a result of feelings about work. And so the cubicle becomes a symbol of the kind of callousness or arbitrariness of office work. I mean, we just were talking about the way that decisions are made by facilities managers or real estate developers that not based on the input of workers. I mean, that's a larger reflection of workers' powerlessness in white-collar workplaces. And I think that's where you start to hate the space you're in mostly.
We're talking with Nikhil Saval, who's the author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. Also joining us in studio is Tony Amenta, who's a principal at Amenta Emma Architects. When we come back from a break, we're going to hear some of your cubicle stories. We want to hear about the workplace that you work in right now. Does it work for you? Do you wish it would change? 860-275-7266. You can always go online and join the conversation at WNPR.org. This is where we live.
Have you ever worked in a cubicle?
Yes, but I do feel like one of those squirrel whack-a-moles, you know, your head pops up and somebody's going to hit you.
Yeah, and I refer to it, and back me up on this, but I refer to it as a soul crusher.
We do. Yes, both of us.
And how do you like that?
It's challenging at times, but it's a community too, so it's got its good things. I don't mind it. I like having a job.
Yeah, there you go.
I used to thought it was okay. I don't like it at all. It's very damaging to the body, I think. You were not created to sit in a cubicle. You have to move.
Do you have any good cubicle stories?
I do, as a matter of fact. The a prior company, I was in a cubicle, and they were doing a re-landscaping of the floor, and I had a junction box underneath my cubicle, so they tore all the cubicles down around me for in a 50-foot radius, and mine was standing in the middle of the floor. I was an island, a cubicle island, for about a week.
Some voices from the streets of Hartford gathered by our intern, Allison Ehrenreich. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live, and we're talking today about the modern American workspace, defined, as always, by the cubicle. A new book called Cubed by Nikhil Saval, A Secret History of the Workplace, has got us talking about this. He joins us today from a studio at WHYY in Philadelphia. Also in studio with us is Tony Amenta, who's a principal at Amenta Emma Architects. In just a moment, we're going to be talking with someone from IDEO. They've been working on new ideas in office design for years, but we're going to get to some of your phone calls. Tom is in Torrington. Hey there, Tom, go ahead.
Hello, yes. My experience is kind of unique, perhaps, maybe not. I, about 2 years ago, moved to Connecticut from Massachusetts, where I was in a cubicle in Massachusetts and had been in cubicles for many years. I found cubicles to be very distracting because the people were too close to me. My kind of work doesn't lend itself to distraction. I have to have sustained concentration to analyze things and follow a logical train of thought in doing so. So when I moved to Connecticut and became a home worker, it improved my ability to do my work quite a bit. I still go in once in a while to the office, and when I get there, I have to get into a conference room by myself in order to concentrate. So, now the CEO has come into the company, new CEO, and wants, this is in California, is the headquarters, and they want to go to this open office without cubicles, and you show up with your laptop and your backpack, and they think there will be a free exchange of ideas, and that'll be much better. But I think they need to understand that that movement kind of doesn't work for people who have to analyze processes and things like that.
And need that sustained concentration, as you talk about. Tom, your story makes a lot of sense to me. Thank you very much for that. Nikhil Saval, you probably heard lots of these stories as you were researching your book. Offices that were designed not necessarily for the work that was being done there. I'm wondering if you have any reactions to Tom, and I'd also like to ask you about how we ended up with the types of workspaces we have today anyway. I mean, what's the historical trend that got us to the place where we have cubicles and now more open office spaces?
It's funny. I mean, what Tom's story, it's certainly, I've heard many versions of that. I mean, and in a way that everyone heard a version of it when Marissa Mayer at Yahoo, you know, wanted to end homeworking and telecommuting and bring everyone to the office to encourage interaction and collaboration. I mean, the kind of ironic thing is that it's true that we have been here before. If you look at sort of the mid-century office, I think a lot of people are maybe familiar with the image of the offices that we used to have up until about the 60s and 70s, which if you've seen Mad Men or films like The Apartment, where it's just row after row of desks in the center, kind of in very orthogonal arrangements. and then the corridor offices around the side for middle managers. Now, this was based initially on the factory. The people conceived of white-collar workspaces as basically appendages to factory work, and they should be arranged like factory work. And the fact was that they were, you know, they had steno typing pools in the center. I mean, there was a lot of work that was lightly mechanical, and so it seemed like it should just be arranged like an assembly line. And it was in the 1950s and 60s that you started to see movements against this. And one of the first was the original open office plan, that, which was called the office landscape, invented in Germany. And that was precisely to encourage more interaction, to better organize paper flow. There were no walls, maybe sound screens, and people were arranged in clusters of desks to facilitate communication. And then Robert Probst, a designer for Herman Miller, added a little element to this plan, which was the action office, which was a kind of three-walled space that was flexible and could be arranged to suit people's needs. And that became the cubicle. The funny thing is, in the 1950s and 60s, the open office plan was seen as being revolutionary. CEOs and managers kept putting it into various workspaces everywhere. The original World Trade Center adopted an open office plan, the office landscape. At the same time, people were complaining about concentration, distraction, lack of privacy. These very complaints that we're seeing again that Tom just voiced today were seen then. And it's usually based on the fact that the CEOs or people conceiving these plans don't work in these spaces, or don't seem to actually have to, you know, they have some lofty idea of what it is people should or are doing. And they don't, you know, and they're often not even in these offices. They're often just traveling or doing meetings or what have you. And it's their conception that determines the way many of us work and live. And so I think that this mistake is being repeated consistently throughout office history.
Well, let's try to be proactive here, Tony Amenta. So we've talked a little bit about the history and what makes some of the workspaces that we work in currently not work so well for us. What's a better workspace? I know you're thinking about this all the time. Build us a better workspace.
Yeah, I think the one thing that it's been consistent with through the ages, as I understand it, is that somebody has decided one way works, and then that one way, through a series of trial and error, we find out it doesn't work at all. So I think what we do, first of all, is we ask a lot of questions, obviously, and try to understand what people's work is all about. But to the caller's point, you know, there can be different points in the day when you need concentration and other points in the day when you want to collaborate. So where we're trying to go, and in fact our own office has developed this way, is that you have alternative spaces to be in. You're not locked into your seat and your desk. If you need to get away, there's a spot where you can lay papers and concentrate that's away from everywhere else. So it's not a dedicated conference room, but it's a different kind of space. There are other places where you can get together, and then if you need to be at your computer, you know, or your laptop, which can rove around wirelessly. So the idea is all about opportunities to do different things at different points in the day. And that's where we're going if folks, feel like they can work that way. I do want to make a comment about work at home.
Yeah.
Which is we did the national standards a couple years ago for the Aetna, and they have about 30% of their workforce that actually works from home. But as opposed to the caller, the way they monitor productivity is every keystroke is monitored so that you can tell whether or not that person is sort of paying attention to their job. Most of these at-work-home workers, as we understand it, like the flexibility of being at home, but there is a certain rigidity, and there's also a certain loss of community. As opposed to the caller, these folks feel disconnected to the mothership and want to come in once in a while to share stories.
But there's two different things you're talking about there. One has to do with maybe the disconnection from their colleagues at work and that community that you build, the conversation that just naturally comes out of that. But then there's the second piece, the very important piece, which a big company like Aetna wants to make sure the people are still working. And really, Nikhil, I think that's part of the factory-like layout that you talked about that rose in the 50s, you know, those perimeter offices with the boss being able to look out to the cubicles and see whether or not people are working. It seems so much of the modern workplaces are presupposing the fact that we're just trying to get away with something, right? That we're not working that hard and somebody's got to keep an eye on us, right?
Yeah, this is, you know, this has long been a conception of what American workers are like and what, you know, that workers are basically lackadaisical and ultimately don't want to work. And this is actually a much more complicated issue of control and domination in the workplace. I mean, you know, in the early 20th century, you had figures like Frederick Taylor, the founder of scientific management, the great efficiency expert. And his conception of workers was precisely this, that workers are always trying to get away with something. And so you have to create methods of surveillance, of control, and also standards of efficiency and you know, how quickly a work should be done. I mean, that issue of monitoring keystrokes comes directly out of this movement, this notion that you should have a certain number of keystrokes each minute or what have you. And there were, you know, there have long been attempts to mitigate this idea, human resources as a and sort of psychology in the workplace have recognized that workers are not necessarily just trying to get away with things, but in a way you if you are in a workplace that treats you as a kind of cog in a machine, it seems likely that you would actually not regard the work as very good, and if you know, and not actually want to do it. I mean, I think that's these attempts at surveillance and control, you know, reflect a severe imbalance in the sense of how workers, you know, what kind of control workers have over their work. And so, you know, working from home, yeah, it does produce challenges for managers in the sense that they can't watch their workers, and so they're clearly finding ways to do that. But it might be another alternative would be if workers actually taking control over their work in a way, and we've never really tried that. And that would be a more interesting way to figure out questions of productivity and things like that.
We're going to get to some more of your phone calls about the changing American workspace in a moment at 860-275-7266. But I want to bring in Tom Ike, who's Chief Technology Officer and a partner at IDEO. They're a company that has long been thinking about ways to innovate around the workspace. And Tom, welcome to our show. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
I know that you talk to an awful lot of people out there. What is your conception of the way we have evolved into the workspaces that we have, and what do you think is a better way forward?
Well, I really appreciate the history lesson from Nikhil's book, which is excellent. I think that we're living in the past in most workspaces. They were built around paper-based processes, and work is rapidly digitalizing and virtualizing, too, and the idea that people are working from home is, I think, part of a huge trend around increasingly contingent workers who are not permanent. And so what needs to happen for me to see the better solutions in the future is something Tony alluded to about a plurality of workspaces that people can come together to use for different purposes throughout the day, but really that support these new, more digital workflows. And I have some examples of that, but it really isn't supported by the current offerings of most furniture manufacturers that are based on, I think, really legacy thinking and models of behavior in the workspace.
Well, maybe you can give me an example quickly, if you would.
Sure. I think that it's hilarious that I spend much of my time in a global role in an open-plan workspace with a headset with earbuds and the mic on, basically talking to a screen and surrounded by other people who are trying to have conversations over my talking to the screen or having their own conversations with their screens. I don't think that's what people want from an open plan workspace, and yet economics have forced most of us to do that or prefer to take the experience elsewhere, like from home.
Mm.
So what we're seeing more of, and what we're certainly doing in our spaces, is we're putting in a lot of phone booths and a lot of medium size rooms that are not hosting any more than, say, three or four people at a time, because the kind of meeting spaces people need in these hybrid virtual to physical meetings are not large spaces, and they have really different kind of acoustic demands than a live meeting room.
One thing I wanted to ask you about, Tom, and our other guests can chime in. I've spent some time working at NPR's new headquarters in Washington. It's a beautiful new building, huge high ceilings, open workspaces. There are cubicles, but people sort of work together very well in these clusters. And all throughout the spaces, Tom, there are these great little meeting areas, you know, two chairs set aside where you could just sit down and have a nice conversation. And I was asking people, because I'm fascinated by this stuff myself, about how well those work and whether or not they use them. And time again, I was told that while it's a great idea, many of the conversations that people needed to have weren't really the sorts of conversations you'd want to have in a hallway with everyone seeing you. And so if you're going to have that conversation, you'd sign out a conference room, just like you would in the cubicle office space of old. I guess I'm wondering, Tom, how you view that sort of thing, these lofty ideals that we may have about a third space to go work, and how that may or may not work with the current work culture or the work being done at the time for that company.
Yeah, I think you've identified a real problem. And a lot of office plans now are saying, let's have a touchdown space for people that's ad hoc, not reserved, and not private. And people need privacy for conversations, whether they're on the phone or with others in small groups. And what I think it hasn't been solved yet, and yet it is the opportunity between architecture and furniture to solve it, is some acoustic interventions that could help. And I'm not talking about white noise generators or the mythical cone of silence. I'm really talking about some different use of materials and ways to capture space acoustically. And instead, I think economics and maybe, again, old legacy thinking have just created a lot of hard surfaces that make acoustics impossible in those open areas, and even worse in the small enclosed areas for things like speakerphone conversations or video conferencing.
Tony, how about you? Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think that I agree that acoustics is a challenge, but I do think there are lots of ways to deal with it. I want to talk about another social space that I witnessed that you guys might appreciate. Doing some work for the insurance companies, they work in teams, a certain number of people. And when I walked through a lot of their facilities, I noticed that there was a place always in these teams where some sort of food offering was there.
Of course, donuts, right?
Right, yeah. Or somebody baked a cake.
We
or
have
this kind
that
of
too.
Thing, you know? So in our new space for them, we actually designed this little area that I called the cake table. And it was just a place where you could, you know, gather and socially. So get away from work a little bit. And there was no acoustical privacy, and it wasn't for that. On the other hand, having these smaller spaces that can be enclosed with better privacy for telephone conversations are also critical. So you, again, we come back to the number of different types of places you have to offer. As the workstations get smaller because of what Tom alluded to with all the electronic, we don't need a lot of place to have stacks of paper anymore. The actual workspace can be smaller. Therefore, you can have then use that leftover space for some of these common areas, whether they're enclosed or open. And then the equation works out to exactly the same square feet per person, if you will.
Well, one of the things that Tony just said that I want to put to you, Nikhil, that I think is so important to realize about workspaces is that the things that humans do almost always spill over and change the spaces that we're enclosed in. Just like the people who put up the tape over the glass in the windows because they don't want to see out or they don't want others to see in. You know, we want to find a place to put the donuts. And after a while, the wonderfully designed meeting space actually becomes a donut space, and then it becomes a junk table. You get my point. And, Nikhil, I guess I'm wondering how you've viewed that in your research for the book, how the basic human nature of people who gather together will almost always change and alter the space they're put in, no matter what those restrictions are.
Yeah, the sense of the need to sort of personalize or make human otherwise sort of anodyne or rather antiseptic workspaces, it does seem like it's a constant. I mean, over the years, I mean, yeah, certainly there's. I mean, I've certainly just in anecdotally seen vast numbers of cubicle designs of people turning their cubicle into like sort of like a tent of sorts, or you know, or like I've seen them string like little Christmas lights in them. But I mean, I think the other thing that you see in the need to personalize is a kind of hostility. I mean, one of the problems is that it becomes, as the guests for as Tony and Tom are pointing out, it becomes increasingly hard in a contemporary setting to justify space, because you it seems like you need less of it. You may not even need to be there. Offices, in a way, have to become more. You have to demand more from them, and so they have to be justified in a way. And so, you know, in a way, what appears to be happening is that the kind of palette of place that that Tom from IDEA was pointing out, the need to have more alternatives and varieties of space, I think is now extending, you know, outside the building envelope itself. It's now extending into cafes or into co-working spaces. I think the sense of personalization is actually really about, not just about, you know, making space your own, but having a sort of choice over where you work in a given day. And so cities in this context become much more important. Cities in some ways tend to cater to office workers. I mean, like all sorts of spaces are being turned into offices. And so, I mean, I don't know. I think there's a way in which, you know, now that, I mean, another sort of side of this is the need to maintain a sort of sense of ambience of, like, of not having everything be digital, of not having everything be in a cloud. I think people do need, you know, and this is what home offices in a way are for, or if you go to a co-working space every day, you may want to keep a desk that's your own. I don't see that really going away. I think it's being challenged by the digital environment, by the reliance on digital workspaces. But I think the need to have artifacts of things that one needs, that one recognizes as one's own, that may even increase with everything sort of moving onto a cloud.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned co-working. We got a tweet from our friend Slade who asks about that and the co-working movement, how that has impacted the workplace. Many people don't even know what that's about, but there are many places in cities where you can just go and plop down at a desk with your computer and work with others and form some new bonds, some relationships, and hopefully some business ideas as well. As we run low on time, Tom, I'm wondering about some of the technological pieces of this and the design pieces of this that we look into. IDEO has done everything from design mouses to, I guess they're mice, that you'd use on your computer, to chairs for the office space. I mean, can just better design ideas, whether it's in ergonomics or in acoustics, can that help to make a better office space, or does it take more than that?
Well, I think actually it has gone beyond that now, and I agree with Nikhil that actually the design of any workspace has to consider its context in a larger setting like a city, and the options that the talent that the company is trying to attract to come into work every day have, because they will choose better options if they can find them, and they're increasingly contingent, so they can find them. I think technology is very important in terms of collaboration, because a lot of collaboration is happening in a hybrid mode, as I mentioned, at a distance and with local teams. And I think most work is now getting done in small teams that need specific fixtures and furnishings from the space that they're doing their work in. If they're doing a project in a project space, depending on the type of project, they may need lots of vertical display, they may need lots of actual physical display, not electronic. And the biggest problem, though, is, I think, the need for support for the digital workflows that they're increasingly using. That is, tools that involve everything from tablets to their phones to their laptops to larger scale pieces of technology. And those can't really be shoehorned into the conference room or the open plan office without actually making major changes to those spaces. So for me, looking especially at our clients and what we have to do for ourselves, it is a burden on the design of the space, but you really have to leverage the context that the space is within and think about the other options that employees will avail themselves of, including outside of the workspace, to get their work done. And that goes to things like hot desking and giving people permanent storage areas but maybe not permanent desks, so that they can sign out desks if they need them, and always have a place to keep their stuff. It goes to definitely giving priority to the talent that you're trying to attract. And that's really what I'm waiting for to see, is when is somebody, and it could be one of the major furniture companies, going to really focus on a talent-led offer that integrates technology in a much more talent-centric way, that really is about what people need in the current and future workflows that they're engaged in.
Tom Ike is Chief Technology Officer and partner at IDEO. We at WNPR have been doing some work with IDEO, and we're thrilled to have him on our program today. And if you want to find out how IDEO helped to design Dilbert's ultimate cubicle, you can go on Twitter right now, and we're tweeting out that story. Tom, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Real quickly, we want to get to Joe in Hartford. Hi, Joe. Go ahead. You got the last word on this.
Okay, great. Great conversation. I like the whole thing about the corporate cubicles, but I wanted to comment on the broader conversation of an environment of what feels like a faceless, soul-sucking corporations who, you know, demand more for less and generally value profits over the common good and shareholders over workers. Your guest had mentioned Taylorism and employee surveillance creeping into everyday corporate life, and that feels very accurate. And, you know, of course, CEO salaries compared to workers, middle-class salaries, which have stagnated. I guess my question is, you know, how have we allowed ourselves collectively to arrive at this point?
It's boy, that's a pretty big question to leave us on, Joe, but I love the question. Nikhil, I'll give you the last word on that. Joe sounds like someone who's a little one of these maybe frustrated cubicle workers, and I think he makes a lot of good points. What do you say?
Well, there are a lot of workers like the caller, and I appreciate the question. I mean, this has happened over generations, and you know, it often came about because workers were not office workers in particular were not organized, and many, I mean, the rates of unionization have been historically very low in offices, and it's really some kind of organization that challenges workplaces to be better, to you know, challenges the control over work. I mean, if you look at European offices, which have been more heavily unionized, they're marginally, I mean, they're a lot, often a lot better, especially in Northern Europe. So, I mean, I think that's what I would not only look forward to, but advocate. I mean, it's a little harder. Tom mentioned the kind of contingency of work and workers that is increasing. So it becomes harder and harder to organize. But I think there is a desire for it on the part of office workers, often if you survey them. And so I think that's how we got to this point. But it doesn't have to end here. I hope it doesn't. And that's sort of what we have to look forward to in the future, is some sort of challenge on the part of workers, some sort of organized resistance to the depredations of corporate life.
Nikhil Saval, editor of N Plus One. He's also author of Cubed, A Secret History of the Workplace. He joined us today from WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks so much for the book and for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks also to Tony Amenta. He's principal at Amenta Emma Architects. Tony, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming in.
That was great fun. Thanks a lot, John.
Now, when we come back, we're going to be hearing about the workspaces that artists inhabit. Joe Figg is a Connecticut-based artist, and he's got a new exhibition at the New Britain Museum of American Art. We'll be talking about that coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up tomorrow, just this past week, we learned that it cost some $250,000 to bring Hillary Clinton to speak at UConn earlier this year. With the cost of higher education going up all the time, there are a lot of questions being raised about this speaking fee. It's one of the stories we'll cover in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. That's coming up tomorrow. I hope you can join us. We've been talking about the changing American workspace. Right now we're talking to Joe Figg. He's a Connecticut-based artist and author of Inside the Painter's Studio, in exhibit New Now. Joe Figg, open from now through July 20th at the New Britain Museum of American Art in New Britain, Connecticut. And we'll have more information on our website, WNPR.org. You're looking inside the workspaces of great artists. And so, Joe, welcome to our program. Thanks for coming.
Thank you, John. It's a pleasure to be here.
So what got you interested in this idea?
Well, I started this project as a study in the creative process and the myth of the lone artist in their sacred studio space. I wanted to get a better understanding of the real day-to-day practicalities of being an artist, how they live and how they work. And I started looking at the studio it's set up to see if that was reflected in the work that was made there.
So a sacred studio space. Tell me about that, because we were just talking about office spaces, and I think some of us view our office spaces somewhere between the place where we do all the creative stuff and also kind of the place the boss makes us sit, right? Yeah. So in the artist world, how is that different, as you call it sacred?
Well, it was interesting listening to the previous conversation and the cubicles. When I was in grad school, every artist had their own little cubicle. And so you would look at their spaces and see that each person's that the work was reflected in that space. But I think it's actually very important for artists to have that privacy and have that place that they could experiment, make mistakes, try new ideas and new things. And I don't know, there a few callers talked about having the cubicle and if that was an issue or not. And it seems I think the artist needs that privacy.
So the artist needs privacy. How do you think the space actually helps the work develop along the way?
Well, I think each artist sets up their space differently, and depending on the type of artist, if you're a painter or a sculptor, you're going to work in that space differently. Painters mostly need just a wall and some space to look at it. I've been finding with sculptors that they, especially if they're better known sculptors, they work with a team of artists, and it does seem that even though they're working with a team, once that team leaves, that's really when they carve out that time to be by themselves and still have a little bit of that private moment to make those aesthetic decisions.
Now, you did a number of interviews with artists as part of this exhibit. Let's actually listen to a clip of you interviewing artist Kate Gilmore.
So then your studio, how long have you been in this studio?
I've been in this studio 3 years.
And your studio is separate from your home. Is that what you prefer, and does that affect the work?
Yeah, I can't work at home. I'm too distracted as it is, and you know, I need a space that's just mine, and even if I just sit here and look at the wall, it's still a space, I'm still doing stuff. I'm too ADD, you know, I need to be away from everyone. I don't want anyone in my space that I don't invite into my space.
And so she's speaking to exactly what you just talked about, right? You want your own space, and you don't want anybody distracting you. I also like this idea that even if you're doing nothing, that's still work.
It's exactly work. And in fact, most artists, what I find often when I would depict one of my sculptures of a artist in their studio, I always depict them at the moment of contemplation, because it seems in that moment where they're actually doing nothing is really when they're working the hardest.
So explain, when people go to the New Britain Museum of Art, what would they see? What is your exhibit? Describe it to us.
Sure. The exhibit includes about 7 or 8 sculptures that are miniature, sort of dollhouse scale, that depict about 7 or 8 artists at work in their studios.
So in you'll be able to sort of see, almost like in diorama fashion, what it looks like to be an artist working in there.
Exactly. And you could also, a number of the pieces have audio, the interview, as part of the sculpture. So you could then put the headphones on, like we have on here, and get inside the studio and listen to the creative process of the artist.
What surprised you about all this? When you talk to artists about this, and even with your own experience as an artist, what did you learn that maybe you didn't know going in?
Well, I think early on, one of the first things I learned, one of the first interviews I did was with the artist Will Cotton, a number of years ago, and I asked him, describe a typical day. And he basically said he gets up around 8, goes out, gets some coffee, starts work exactly at 9, takes lunch around noon, and finishes up at 5, a real standard business day. And that was just shocking, I guess, at the time. And so I think artists, what I've come out is perseverance and persistence. Artists are incredibly hard workers, and work very long hours and are very dedicated to what they're doing.
And that, I think, is in just the last minute that we have, that's what ties back to this book that we talked about with Office Space, is that artists aren't often seen in the general American public as hard workers. They're seen as, well, the people who get to have just time to create and thoughtful. But to be an artist means to work constantly, to hustle all the time, as well as do this deep, intense work. And that's something that I think you get across in this.
Well, definitely. And I think the successful artists are successful just like anyone who's successful is successful, because they're hard workers and they're persistent. And they're doing something hopefully that they love and have an interest in. But it's really just the number of hours that they put in. They're incredibly hard workers.
If I was to walk into your workspace where you do your art, what does it look like?
I'm in the old Axe Factory in Collinsville. So it's a great old building, and there's a lot going on. It's really, for me, a workspace, and as opposed to an exhibition space.
And it's a beautiful place to work. I can only imagine being around that much history with those big, beautiful open spaces right next to the river. Probably a pretty good place to create some stuff. Joe Figg is a Connecticut-based artist. His studio is right there in Collinsville. And he's got an exhibition open to July 20th. New now, Joe Figg, inside the Painter's Studio. It's the New Britain Museum of American Art. You can go to nbmaa.org if you want to find out more. Joe, thanks for stopping by. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome, John. Thank you.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. Thanks to Allison Ehrenreich for her help today. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.